Now, 100 years, as religions go, especially a religion like Buddhism, is not a very long time. But it is quite long enough for various changes to take place. When I speak of changes, I don't mean just the developments to which I've already referred, these three periods, but I mean rather changes in the very approach to Buddhism. 100 years is quite long enough a period for changes of approach through the religion also to have taken place in this country. I need hardly remind you what a very, very complex, sometimes bewilderingly complex phenomenon Buddhism is. All sorts of aspects, teachings, levels, schools, and so on. And it may so happen that different aspects of Buddhism or different teachings within the whole body of Buddhism may appeal more strongly at different times, according to difference of circumstances, different problems which arise, and so on. So therefore we may say that those aspects of Buddhism, or those teachings, parts of Buddhism, which appealed perhaps more strongly or even most strongly 50 years ago, are not those which appeal so much to people nowadays. It's not that those aspects or those teachings or those features are absent, but they've become less important. They don't occupy the center of the picture any longer, but they've drifted, as it were, imperceptibly towards the periphery. Now, one might generalize a bit and say that 50 years ago, people in this country, if they were attracted to Buddhism at all, were attracted mainly by three things. First of all, they were attracted by the personality of the Buddha, as a human being, as a teacher, as a historical figure, as someone wise and compassionate, and so on. Secondly, they were attracted by the ethics of Buddhism, its code of conduct, the virtues which it lays down for its followers to practice. And thirdly and lastly, they were attracted by Buddhism's teaching of karma and rebirth. These, if we examine the literature, the books, and the articles produced in those days, seem to be the three features, the three aspects of Buddhism which most strongly attracted people then. The personality of the Buddha, the ethical teachings, and the teaching of karma, or action, reaction, and rebirth. Now today, I would say, on the basis of my own experience, that people tend to be attracted rather by other features of Buddhism. It's not that they don't admire the personality of the Buddha any longer. They certainly continue to admire it very much. They certainly appreciate the ethics of Buddhism and so on. But it is not these aspects, we may say, which are decisive in bringing them into closer contact with Buddhism, or even in inducing them to describe themselves as Buddhists, to take the three refuges or go for the three refuges to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, as in traditional terms we say. Now, one can observe that there are both negative and positive reasons for this change. I want to go into that a little later on. First, let us just try to understand why it was 50 years ago that people were attracted by the three aspects or the three features of Buddhism which I've just mentioned. The first thing we have to bear in mind, I think, is that we cannot isolate the history of Buddhism in this country from the total religious history of the country. You can't separate it. It's part, however exotic it may seem, however even bizarre it may seem in some people's eyes at times, the history of this religion, Buddhism, in this country is a part of the general religious history of our times. Can't be separated therefrom. Now, during the second half of the last century, in this country, the hold of Christianity, certainly of Orthodox, dogmatic Christianity, on people generally, especially the more thinking people, was very considerably, very seriously weakened. Partly as a result of scientific explorations and discoveries, origin of species, study of comparative religion, and all that, and partly for other reasons into which I need not go at present. But what happened was, and one can become very aware of this if one studies the general literature of the time, biographies and diaries and so on, what happened was that Christianity became less and less intellectually acceptable to a great many sincere and thoughtful people who weren't by any means irreligious, who weren't by any means spiritually insensitive. It became intellectually unacceptable. At the same time, though it was intellectually unacceptable, they remained, in a way, a rather strange sort of way, emotionally involved in it. They could emancipate themselves from the dogmatic, doctrinal side intellectually, but their heartstrings, as it were, remained tied to the beliefs and practices, customs, traditions of their childhood and youth. Now, for these people, originally, one can say, Christianity had meant three things. This is especially true of the evangelicals, who were very prominent in English religious, even social and political life in those days. Christianity meant, in the first place, devotion to the person of Christ as the Saviour, as the incarnate Son of God. It also meant an ethical code by which they could shape their actions, by which they could live. The Ten Commandments of the Old Testament, the Sermon on the Mount of the New, and so on. And finally, Christianity gave them the hope of life after death. Perhaps we can't understand nowadays how strong an element that was in religion in the last century. I remember when I was a boy of about, I think, 13 or 14, I was sent down to the West Country to stay with some friends. So I stayed in a very old rambling house, which was decorated and furnished in the style, I think it must have been, of the 60s and 70s of the last century. And I remember that in the bedroom in which I was put, there were very large framed religious pictures on the walls. And one showed angels welcoming the departing soul into heaven, and another showed a little bevy of angels having what appeared to be a little gossip, and another showed the heavens opening and the faithful soul aspiring upwards. There were all these sort of religious pictures on the walls. So this illustrates the fact that in the minds, in the hearts also of our forefathers, not so many decades, not so many generations ago, the hope of life after death, even the conviction that after death you'd go straight to heaven, preferably, was very, very strong indeed. One can even find references to this sort of thing in popular fiction. If you take, for instance, Dickens's, nowadays we would call it a very over-sentimental, even pathetic description of the death of poor little Nell, how the snow was falling, and as she passed away, the voices of the angels could be heard calling her to her everlasting rest. He does really lay it on very thick and very heavy. But that is what our Victorian forefathers appreciated, because they felt, they believed this very, very strongly. But after Christianity became intellectually acceptable, of course, this faith was very much weakened, perhaps disappeared entirely. As I've said, though, even after the intellectual abandonment of Christianity, these people, often, as I must insist, very sincere worthy people felt an emotional need for something equivalent to these three things, which had satisfied them in Christianity. So some of these people, towards the end of the last century, some of them, not very many, but a few, found them in Buddhism. Now in the Buddha, in the person of the Buddha, we can say they found what we can describe as a non-theological Christ. That is, they found a figure, a historical figure, so far as they could see, with all the virtues of Christ, all the virtues traditionally associated with Christ, plus perhaps a few more, but without the encumbrance, not to say embarrassment, of Trinitarian theology. In the second place, they found in Buddhism a code of ethics, a moral code by which to live, but without any supernatural sanction, with, if anything, a purely humanistic sanction. They found, one can say, the Sermon on the Mount, but without the Mount. The Mount, of course, being the dogmatic doctrinal background. And again, in the teaching of karma and rebirth, they found a more rational, or what appeared to them a more rational basis for their hope in a future life or a future existence. Now, with regard to this last item, we can see their attitude was rather different from the Eastern attitude. In the East, this idea of rebirth, the idea that you'll have to come back again, even after the flames of the funeral pyre have died down, is accepted implicitly. No one ever argues about it, no one ever discusses it, it's just accepted. In the East, in India, or in a Buddhist country, I think, I don't exaggerate in saying, that you won't ever get a lecture on karma and rebirth. It isn't necessary. No one needs it, no one requires it. They just take it for granted. That there is such a thing as rebirth, that you come back again and again and again. But they also view it as a very terrible thing. It's nothing to be very happy about, nothing to be very proud of, that you come back again and again. They think it's a very miserable sort of process, having to come back and get into a body, all its limitations, all its pain, all its suffering, over and over again. Rebirth is a terrible thing in the East. So nirvana, freedom from rebirth, represents the possibility of escape from all that. Now, in the West, 50 years ago, for these people about whom we're speaking, after the collapse of belief in Christianity, the prospect that after death there would be no life, annihilation as it were, this was a terrible thing. And this teaching of karma and rebirth represented for them the possibility of escape from this terrible predicament or terrible prospect. So we can see how different the two attitudes were. In the East, rebirth is a terrible thing, you've got to escape from it. But in the West, at the end of the last century for these people, it was the prospect of no life after death which was terrible. So this idea of karma and rebirth came to them as a sort of salvation from that. Now to generalize, we can say that some of those people, towards the end of the last century, in this country, who in all sincerity and good faith took to Buddhism, were really treating Buddhism as a sort of Christianity substitute. This is what happens then. Now, there's nothing wrong with this, so far as historical development is concerned. This is an intermediate stage in the development of Buddhism in this country, which we have to expect. It's only natural that you can't jump all at once, as it were, into a new, strange, oriental religion like Buddhism. You have to go down into it gradually, step by step. You have to go from the known to the unknown. So in these early days, it's only to be expected, it's only natural that you get people coming into Buddhism, I won't say for the wrong reasons, because the sincerity was there, but certainly treating Buddhism to some extent, if not to a great extent, as a sort of Christianity substitute. we can now begin to see, I think, why today the position is rather different.